No, thank you for being up now. There's a story behind my presentation, which is the following. Last year, when Abner and I conducted a dialogue on Whitehead's philosophy and quantum mechanics in Vienna, on the occasion of Anton Zeilinger's 60th birthday conference, Abner assigned me the task of winning the argument and restoring his enthusiasm and love for Whitehead. I tried and failed. It's not easy to win an argument with Abner, as you know. But I haven't given up. And today is the next try. So I consider this talk a second chance to fulfill Abner's task. In less than an hour, you will know whether this time I succeeded. That's the story. Now, what's the relationship between Abner and Whitehead? Following J.M. Berger, who established back in the 1960s the intriguing connection between process philosophy and quantum mechanics, Abner has been one of the champions, if not the champion, of this connection. It was primarily Lovejoy's book, Revolt Against Dualism, that convinced him otherwise. The point that convinced him seemed to be the vagueness in the term experience, which made it so far from the usual meaning of the term that it seemed to him virtually meaningless. Is that right, Abner? Have I represented you correctly? Abner? All right. Early on, Abner showed that certain modifications of Whitehead's philosophy as originally formulated are indispensable. As we shall see, other modifications are needed to deal with the entanglement issue. The question is whether the modified version enriches or destroys the Whiteheadian paradigm. So this will be the main point. Since the very existence of a relationship of Whitehead's philosophy, also known as process philosophy, and quantum mechanics may be news to some of us, I will begin by establishing this intriguing connection. By the way, if I'm going too fast or anything, please let me know somehow. The connection is based on the Whiteheadian concept of actual entities, also known as actual occasions, throbs of experience, or pulses of experience, depending on the context. They are, according to Whitehead, the atoms of reality. The enormous gulf between Whitehead and contemporary scientific thinking is revealed already at this stage. According to Whitehead, this universe we live in is an alive universe, a universe of experiences rather than a universe of mostly inanimate matter. We will come back to this point in a few minutes. Actual entities are processes. That's the first thing. They are processes, hence the name process philosophy. They are processes of their own self-creation. They have both an objective and subjective aspects. And as soon as they are completed, they die. Dying, they become immortal in the sense that the fact that they existed cannot be erased. In saying that actual entities are processes of their own self-creation, creativity is implied. Whitehead's universe is not a completely deterministic one. It is a universe characterized by the phrase creative advance into novelty. The time constraints do not allow me to elaborate further. I'm mentioning these points just to whet your appetites. Being introduced to Whitehead's thinking is a challenging, difficult, and rewarding experience. But how is it related to quantum mechanics? Before addressing the question of a possible correspondence between process philosophy and quantum mechanics, we need to put one more ingredient into the soup. This ingredient is Schrödinger's principle of objectivation. Let's see what that is. When I recently discussed with Abner the role of great physicists as philosophers, he said that Schrödinger is in a class by himself, and I agree. According to Schrödinger, science as it is practiced now is based on two principles. The first, the belief that nature is comprehensible. It's a belief, as far as, well, it is a belief. And the second, the principle of objectivation. Now, by this, the principle of objectivation, I mean what is also frequently called the hypothesis of the real world around us. I maintain that it amounts to a simplification, which we adopt in order to master the infinitely intricate problem of nature. Without being aware of it, and without being rigorously systematic about it, we exclude the subject of cognizance from the domain of nature that we endeavor to understand. We step with our own person back into the part of an onlooker who does not belong to the world, which by this very procedure becomes an objective world. Now, I'm aware that this is a difficult idea to follow. So I'll read it again. It's very important. By this, that is by the principle of objectivation, I mean what is also frequently called the hypothesis of the real world around us. I maintain that it amounts to a certain simplification, which we adopt in order to master the infinitely intricate problem of nature. Without being aware of it and without being rigorously systematic about it, we exclude the subject of cognizance from the domain of nature to endeavor to understand. We step with our own person back into the part of an onlooker who does not belong to the world, which by this very procedure becomes an objective world. So, let's go back to the correspondence. I suggest that the quantum mechanical process that correspond to an actual entity is the collapse of quantum state. Like an actual entity, a collapse is an atemporal process that is not completely deterministic. Hence, there is room for creativity. I use the term atemporal process. What does this mean? What are these? The process of self-creation of an actual entity is not a process of time. It is rather an atemporal process leading to the momentary appearance of the completed actual entity in space-time. Quoting Whitehead, in the process of self-creation, which is an actual entity, the genetic process from phase to phase is not in physical time. The genetic process is not a temporal succession. Each phase of the genetic process presupposes the entire quantum. The word quantum here, by the way, doesn't mean much. It's simply used as a word from Whitehead's point of view. It's not anything like we mean by quantum now. But the idea is very clear. So here are some examples of atemporal processes. First, the creation in Plato's Timaeus comes after many other acts of creation. The creation of time in Plato's Timaeus comes after many other acts of creation. All of these must be atemporal because they don't have time yet. Okay? And the Platonic participation in the forms, in the sensible thing, is another example of atemporal processes. If the idea of a horse participates in a beautiful horse, then all of this takes place atemporally, and then later all we see is a beautiful horse. Now, Whitehead's thinking was Platonic, and his precision was a mathematician's. Therefore, his inclusion of atemporal processes in his system is significant. Now, having digressed there is a typo here. Let us return now to the correspondence between actual entities and the collapse. The final result of the collapse is an elementary quantum event in space-time. The final state of an actual entity is likewise an event in space-time. The correspondence works except for one problem. The problem with the correspondence of the collapse to an actual entity is that quantum mechanics, as a part of our science, is subject to the principle of objectivation. The collapse, as it is now understood, has nothing subjective about it. An actual entity, however, has both a subjective aspect and an objective aspect. Subjective, by the way, means in relation to the entity itself, not in relation to us, or watching or dealing with it. I hope that's clear. So the conclusion that I'm driving to is this. The collapse corresponds to an actual entity to the extent that our science would allow it to. That is, correspond to the objective aspects of an actual entity. When one follows, point by point, the characteristic of actual entities, one is amazed to what extent one can think of collapse is an objectivized actual entity. So let's go now to Bell correlations and actual entities. The relationship between Whitehead's thought and quantum mechanics is a two-way street. Quantum mechanics adds credence to the Whiteheadian vision, and Whitehead's philosophy helps us understand the apparently weird aspect of quantum mechanics. We will now embark on a re-examination of the EPR and Bell's correlation from Whiteheadian perspective. The EPR-Bell correlation seems to show that something, call it influence, travels faster than light. But this faster than light travel cannot be harnessed to transmit signals. How can we understand this strange state of affairs? A modification of process philosophy is needed. Not knowing about entanglement, Whitehead naturally assumed that an actual entity is especially confined to a small region. Let's modify process philosophy by dropping this requirement. Let's assume that one actual entity can end up occupying two or more distant locations. How is this modification related to the EPR-Bell situation? In an EPR-Bell experiment, two events that take place at the same time seem to influence each other, regardless of the distance between them. In principle, this distance can be astronomical. Even when the events take place very far apart, they seem to be entangled, to feel each other. Is it possible that such a connection takes place because both events are a single creative act, a single actual entity arising out of a common field of potentialities? A single act of transition from potential to the actual that occurs in two places is not the result propagation of anything between these two places. And the speed of light barrier does not apply. Yeah. This is why such creative acts cannot be utilized to transmit faster than light signals faster than light. To transmit a signal, two creative acts are required. The transmission and reception of a signal is precisely the creation of a situation where the one completed actual entity affects another. Such transmission cannot propagate faster than light. The distinction between influences and signals reflects the distinction between two events that are components of a single act of self-creation and two events that are connected and yet distinct creative acts. A mundane analogy may clarify this distinction. Think of a dancer in an act of performing. In a single creative act we have been discussing correspond to the dancer gracefully lifting her left leg and her right arm in one harmonious movement. In contrast, the two distinct events correspond to the appearance of an itch on the dancer's left leg and scratching it with her right hand. The graceful lifting of the arm and leg is really a single movement. Its two correlated components take place simultaneously. The two events of itching and scratching are separated in time, since one is a reaction to the other. The material covered so far is a prelude to the big question we are now ready for, and I'll put it this way. The main point of Lovejoy's objection, which Abner endorses, is the loose use of terms like experience or mentality. Differently stated, the possible meaning of such terms, as Whitehead used them, is so vague that one wonders whether they mean anything at all. This is a serious objection. I believe, however, that by using this term, Whitehead tries to indicate something that is not vague at all. The idea, I believe, is he had in mind, and obviously this is my formulation, is this. If the basic units of the universe are dead, no amount of complexity will make them alive. The negation of the physicalist approach means that the presence of mentality at the human level tells us that some level of mentality, however insignificant in itself, must be present at all levels. I'm not telling the proto mentality is appropriate in this context. Here's another point. To the best of my knowledge, Lovejoy was not aware of either the correspondence of process philosophy and quantum mechanics, or of the issue of entanglement. Thus, he staked his position against Whitehead, being blissfully ignorant of the two unexpected major triumphs of process philosophy, in terms of what Whitehead called elucidation of things observed. Because of the results of what Abner called experimental metaphysics, we no longer have the luxury of being blissfully ignorant. One cannot ignore a metaphysical approach that corresponds so well to quantum mechanics and gives an elegant explanation of the characteristics of the entanglement. I rest my case. Well, let's have some conversation. How do you do, Abner? Thank you. Well, if you don't, this is not the end. Wait. I was just waiting for that. You know, my son said that a good life is a successful application of plan B. So here's plan B. Let me begin by stating that I'm trying to achieve what I'm not trying to achieve in this presentation. I'm not trying to arrive at anything like a metaphysical statement is final. Okay, no finality is assumed. Rather, I expect Whitehead's statement would remain the final reflection, how shallow, puny, and imperfect are efforts to sound the depth in the nature of things. In philosophical discussion, the merest hint of dogmatic certainty as to finality of statement is an exhibition of folly. It's from the introduction to Protestant reality. What I am trying to arrive at is a metaphysical system that is true in the following sense. Number one, it feels true. Number two, it is non-dogmatic in the sense of being open to possible changes. And number three, it is in line with the finding of physics in general, and quantum mechanics in particular. Does this modified version of process philosophy, does it fit the bill? One, it feels true. It does feel true. If it didn't, then Abner had to explain how come he was an Whiteheadian for so many decades. Second, it is not dogmatic. As we saw, it can be modified to great advantages, no major damage. And three, it is in line with the finding of quantum mechanics in general and with the EPR Bell entanglement in particular. So, to conclude, 64,000 question to Abner. Given that we are not looking for a final metaphysical statement, would you agree that a modified process philosophy is the best one we have currently? Yeah, but right. But look, Abner, you have a theory which corresponds to quantum mechanics and corresponds to and put the entanglement in a very elegant light. What do you do with that? Just throw it out? Yeah. I see. What souls are what do you demand? Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Maybe it will take me another year to try again. Yes. Well, if you drop the requirement that what Whitehead calls actual entities have to be in one spot, if the same actual entity manifests in two spots, then up until the manifestation, you have one field of potentialities.
Well, and
no, I don't think so. Look.
For an attitude of the dancer, I think there's particularly in this meeting, because in the case of the dancer, there's a common cause of the correlation between the leg and the arm.
Yep.
Whereas it's precisely the no-go results of battle and experience that rule out any such explanation.
Sure, the dancer is not an explanation. The dancer is not. Well, I do suggest that you read some Whitehead, but the point is that Whitehead, from his own side, without any application of physics, came up with this distinction, and the distinction just by modifying his distinction, there is one creative act. This is a Whitehead. This is a vintage Whitehead. Don't need any physics or anything for that, but just by making this possibility. A possibility of not confining it to one region in space, you get something. Now, this something disappears once you want to try to transmit a signal. So it's explanation why you can transmit in so-called influences, which I don't think it's transmitted at all, and you can't transmit a signal. So you cannot transmit a signal. Influences you can, but signals you cannot. So it has some explanatory power. Yes.
It's been a big project updating Whitehead.
Yeah.
Could I suggest another project to update Whitehead?
In the light of? Well, we talked about it. I suppose the problem is that I don't believe that if you have something that has no life in it at all, you make it very complex, it becomes conscious or alive. So I think that in order for anything to be alive, then at any level, even the lowest, it has to be just the slimmest glimmer of something. Otherwise, I don't think how it comes about. That's complexity, I don't think we'll do it. But that's just... No, you don't. Because we speak especially about creativity. This is the Whitehead's main, one of three main words that he uses without definition are creativity. So you have to know when to use it. You have to become a bit of a Whiteheadian. You can't just you know. But having become a bit of a Whiteheadian, I'm very, very appreciative of exactly how and when this thing can be used, and it can be used well, I believe. Yeah, please. And you know that. Well, yeah, I see. Well, the trouble with a mystical thing is that it may be true. The trouble with mystical experiences and things, they may be true. I mean, Heisenberg has two fantastic experiences, both of mystical. One led to the discovery of his scientific principle, and the other did nothing of the kind. But in terms of himself, it was equally strong. So, I mean, when you enter into mysticism, you can expect surprises. There is one more thing I'd like to give you. I think we have time for that. Yeah, I need about 15 more minutes. And this is a movie about the principle of objectivation. I know that it's a difficult principle, so at one point I had three of my students enact it. They enact sections from my book, Nature Loves to Hide. So if you have the patience, I think we have the time, then we can see it. It's about 15 minutes long. Okay? Yeah.
What does he mean when he says we exclude the subject of cognizance from the domain of nature that we endeavor to understand?
Well, before we try to answer that, let's backtrack. Does it make sense to you to think of objectivation as a process?
No, it doesn't. I understand what an object is. This cup of coffee standing here on the table is an object. I perceive it as existing right here in front of me. I understand what a subject is. I, the one who perceives this cup of coffee, am the subject. But the expression, the process of objectivation, sounds strange to me. You can even make a verb out of it, can't you? You can say, I objectivize, right? But what kind of activity would that be?
It would be the activity of creating the world of objects around us.
Creating the world of objects around us? What do you mean? I see this cup of coffee. I don't create it.
Are you sure?
Oh, please, Judy, really? Now, look, sitting down, standing up, lifting my cup, and drinking my coffee are just things that I do. Creation is just not the word for it. I mean, when I look at this cup of coffee, I'm just seeing it the way it is. I don't create it.
Are you sure?
Of course I am. Look here, Julie. Whenever I do something or create something, I'm aware of either doing it or creating it, right? Here I am, lifting my arm. I do that, I feel myself doing that. Now, look at this cup of coffee. I'm aware that I'm looking at it, but not of doing anything to the cup, let alone creating it.
It is not true that while you're doing something, you are always aware of doing it. Just a few minutes ago, you told me that as you were driving on the interstate, you had a lapse of awareness between exit 3 and exit 8, the exit you took to come here. You remember the moment when you came back to yourself while taking exit A. It's like I've been asleep and just woke up, you said. This actually happens all the time. Past exit 3, we're doing lots of things. Keeping the car on the road, changing lanes, not to mention looking at all the pretty women drivers as you pass, all without knowing that you were doing them. This is just one example of doing without awareness. Believe me, there are lots of others.
I'll be damned. That's just like something out of the past from Schrodinger that we're discussing. Without being aware of it, and without being rigorously systematic about it, we exclude the subject of cognizance from the domain of nature. It's actually written right here in black and white, without being aware of it. So he's pretty much saying that objectivation, whatever it is something I do without even being aware of doing it.
Perception is a construct.
Okay. Please run this one by me. I promise I won't hit that this time.
All right. Start by looking at this spoon. It is a whole unbroken spoon. Now I put it in a glass of water. What do you see?
See a broken spoon.
But this is a whole spoon. How come you see it broken?
Well, I can explain that. That's elementary physics. Part of the spoon is in water and part in air. The rays of light that come to our eyes from the part that's in water change their direction when they reach the surface of the water. That's called refraction. So when these rays of light that start in the water reach our eyes, they seem to be coming from a different direction, not the direction they actually came from. But I'm sure that's not the point you were trying to make. What is your conclusion?
My conclusion is that you don't see the spoon. What you see is your mental construct of the spoon. You construct a construct created by your mind on the basis of the directions from which the light has arrived to your eyes. If you actually saw the spoon, you wouldn't have seen a broken spoon, but a whole spoon. By the way, neurologists who research the visual cortex, the part of the brain in which images such as the image of the spoon are created, have found that only about half of the information coming into this part of the brain come from sensory inputs. The other half comes from other parts of the brain. The visual cortex is far from being a passive recipient of sensory input. In fact, it's very active. It uses all kinds of input to construct the image of the spoon that you see in front of you. This activity is as close as our science can get to describing the process of objectivation we are talking about. The secret is, and it is quite a secret, that this process takes place totally outside our field of awareness. Schrodinger was very precise when he added the phrase, without being aware of it. What we are aware of is the final product, and the final product only, this stupid spoon.
So that's what Julie meant when she said perception is the creation of mental construct. I don't see the spoon. What I see is an image that I construct. As far as seeing goes, each of us lives in his or her private world of visual images.
When you look, how is a basketball different from the moon?
Are you all right? Do you need a glass of water, a martini or something?
No, seriously. When you look, how is a basketball different from the moon?
All right, Julie. You know I give you more credit than I give anyone else, so play along with me. Basketball and the moon. Well, there are lots of differences.
What I mean is this. Suppose you look at a basketball from a distance, so that it seems to be about as big as the moon. Forget about the differences and the little details you see on either. What is the major difference in your perception?
Basketball looks like a round sphere. The moon looks like a flat plate.
Right! Now, next question. Since both the basketball and the moon are really round spheres, why does one look like a round sphere and the other like a flat plate?
Well, that's because the light rays from the moon are exactly the same as the light rays from the flat plate. There's nothing in the configuration of the light rays to indicate a round, spherical object.
True enough. But isn't it the same with a basketball? If so, why do they look different?
I don't know.
All right, I'll tell you. The reason for the difference is that whenever you play basketball, we use a basketball. We never use the moon.
Of course not. What does that have to do with anything?
Actually, a lot. Take a look at it this way. Our only experience of the moon is visual. And as you've just explained, as far as visual experience goes, there is nothing to indicate a spherical shape rather than a flat one. For the basketball, however, it's different. We not only look at it, we also touch it, and touching it, we know it's round. This experience of touch is included in the information that the brain uses when it constructs the image of the basketball. This simple example shows that what's going on in the brain is real creation, the creation of mental constructs. These mental constructs are perceived as if they exist as actual objects, rather than as what they are, as mere mental constructs.
Come to think of it, I've heard a different explanation. We see the depth of things with the help of the stereo effect of the eyes. The eyes are situated in slightly different locations, therefore their perspectives on the things we see is slightly different. We create a three-dimensional image by combining and integrating these two perspectives. That's easy enough to do with the basketball, but the moon is so far away that there's no perceptible difference between the two perspectives of the eyes.
Well, this may be true, but it's only part of the story. When we look at round earthly objects that we know are round, we see them as spherical, even though they are too far away for the stereo effect to be effective. A big balloon seen from a distance is one example. And if we accept your explanation, still the integration of the two perspectives of the two eyes into a single coherent image is no mean task. By the way, it takes us a long time to learn how to create these images, these mental constructs. For 2 or 3 years, we were very busy learning how to do it.
Really? What do you mean?
Well, I mean the first 2 or 3 years of our lives. The Swiss psychologist Jean Jay studied this process of learning in great detail. For example, when a baby is about 18 months old or so, his or her perception is confined to two dimensions. The baby doesn't see depth. It hasn't learned that yet.
Yes, I have verified that myself. While our oldest son was a baby, I was very much into Piaget, so I watched him closely with Piaget's findings in mind. It so happened that this baby stood up and walked by himself very early, at 8 or 9 months. At the time, we lived in an apartment that had rooms on 2 levels. When I was upstairs with him, it was scary. He would walk towards the stairs, ready to step on them, as if they were painted on the floor. He clearly did not have the perception that included the possibility of falling down these stairs.
So, perception is the creation of a mental construct. The capacity to be creative in this way is hard-won. Babies work hard to acquire it. Once we have this capacity, we use it all the time and we are totally unaware that we do it. What we call external reality is something we create, we objectivize, and yet we believe it is simply there. The word objectivized is appropriate. We create the objects we see all around us. Now we are ready to address Peter's question.
Wait, what question?
Why, the very question that started our whole conversation. What does Schrodinger mean by the statement, we exclude the subject of cognizance from the domain of nature that we endeavor to understand?
It was getting late. We got up and started strolling along the sidewalk, objectivizing shop windows, passing people, cars, as well as each other. After a few minutes, Julie spoke.
Your question, Peter. Are you sure you don't know the answer already? It's so obvious, so basic, that I find it hard to explain. Let me see. When we look around, we see this external world nicely ordered in space. In this vast space, filled, as it were, with objects and void. Where are you?
Me? Right here.
No, your body is here. Where are you?
Where am I? Inside my body, I suppose.
Oh, really? Where? Certainly not in your toenails. Not even in your arms or legs. They could be amputated. Oh yeah, you'd still be here. Not even in your heart. You could have a heart transplant and you will still be here.
Well, I am in my brain.
Where in your brain?
How could I know? I can't even name the parts of the brain. The neurologist should know that, especially the neurosurgeons.
So, when you undergo brain surgery, you expect the surgeon to find you somewhere in the deep recesses of your brain.
Oh, I see what you mean. No matter where you look, legs, heart, brain, all you see is bones, tissues, neurons. You never see me or you.
Right. How could you see me or you? Whenever you see objects. As far as the question of what you are is concerned, one thing is certain. You are not an object. You are the subject. This space that is all around us is a space of objects, and you, the subject, will never be found in it, because you are not an object. This exclusion of you and me is an integral part of the process of objectivation. When we objectivize, we do two things all at once. Well, it's really one process, but the process has two aspects to it. We construct the world of objects, and we exclude the subject of cognizance from it. Schrodinger put it very well. We exclude the subject of cognizance from the domain of nature that we endeavor to understand. We step with our own person back into the part of the non-looker who does not belong to the world, which by this very procedure becomes an objective world.
I almost see what you mean. I just need a little more help.
Well, there's not much more I can do for you by the way of explanations. I mean, the idea of objectivation is not only profound, it's also very simple. If we try to explain it too much, we're in danger of getting caught up in the words. But I can do something else for you. I can give you an analogy.
Well, let's hear it.
You and I are characters in this book that Shimon Malim has written. Shimon objectifies us as these characters, right?
Yes, of course. He doesn't he even has the pleasure of being with him. And as he walks here with you, it doesn't say much that he is here. Meet your author, as they say in those literary ads.
No, you got it all wrong. This Shimon Malim, who is walking with me, is not the author. He's one of the characters, like us.
I don't get it.
Look, why is Shimon walking here with us? Because the author, back at the beginning of the previous section, decided to write, the three of us were sitting at a coffee shop. He could have left himself out. He could have written, Julian Peter met in a coffee shop.
Sure, he had his reasons.
Oh, I don't doubt it. That's not the point. The point is that this Shimon, who is walking next to me, is as dependent on the author as we are. And Shimon Malim, the author, is nowhere to be found in the book. He is like the subject of cognizance that cannot be found in the objectivized world.
I follow that. It's like when you dream. You, the dreamer, objectifies the whole dream, and you also take part in the dream as one of the dream figures, one person among many. So, in a dream situation, there are two of you, the dreamer and the dream figure. The two have the same name. Both are Julie. One Julie is the dreamer, lying in bed, dreaming. The other is Julie in the room, in the dream, talking to people, going to a party, drowning, fighting, or whatever. The first Julie is not in the dream. The second Julie is not dreaming.
Right. Now, in the dream situation, I, as the dream figure, am liable to make enormous efforts to get something done or to avoid some imminent danger. If I knew I was the dreamer, I could change the dream easily, any way I choose.
So, that's my situation. I can work hard to achieve something as a character in the book, or else he can get it done as easily as the author. Look, Peter, suppose I'm attracted to Julie, and I wish to be alone with her at this point in the book. I can do one of two things. I can try to get you out of the way, one way or another, saying perhaps that it's getting late, or and it's time for me to take Julie home. You will say, sure, let's both accompany her home, at which point I'll feel stupid or frustrated
or what?
Or he can sit at his desk and write. As they were walking, Peter remembered all of a sudden that he had an important engagement. Hurriedly, he took his leave. Julie and Shimon, having waved goodbye to him, looked into each other's eyes They knew then, at that instant, that they loved each other. See? It's all done. Not only is Shimon left alone with Julie, he is even assured that she is as attracted to him as he is to her.
Yes, but in this case, this mutual attraction is not very meaningful for him, is it? Shimon, the author, has created a passionate attraction between two of his characters. Big deal. It's very different from being in love with Julie, who's right here.
Yes, nothing's perfect.
Yay!
The
equation itself doesn't tell you that, so you need a second equation. The second equation gives the mathematical expression for the probability of nature choosing this fluctuating field. Now, it's interesting to me that some of the ideas that you've expressed here from Whitehead seem to correspond to this. The evolution equation is something evolving in time, but the probability rule is not. That is to say, if something on if a fluctuating field on the right and a fluctuating field on the left at any instant of time are have, let's say, a particular value which supports the continuance of the superposition, that lowers the probability. And it's an instantaneous interaction, something that is just taking place right there. It is, there's no temporal thing that's going on. In fact, nature is independently doing a creative act, if you want to think of it, at each point of space, because I have no equation for the evolution of a fluctuating field. It's an arbitrary fluctuating field of white noise type. It can be doing any damn thing it wants to do. So if it does any damn thing it wants to do, and it doesn't do it right, that is to say, it doesn't leave one of these things to survive and the other ones disappear, that's going to be a very low choice on the part of nature. So it just seems to me that the verbal connection that you've been making here to Whitehead's ideas seem to have a little bit of resonance to this particular structure. And indeed, you pointed out that because the heart of this was in the collapse of wave function, which is, in a way, an explanation of why you get failed correlations and so forth and so on. It is a non-local theory because these fields are correlated in a non-local way, but it's an independent decision. So
well, listen, Phil, to hear this from you, I mean, it's amazing, absolutely amazing. But the other thing I want to say, in the aim, you see, with Whitehead, everything, when it's formed itself, has a subjective, what you call a subjective aim. And there are like three chapters about this in Postal Reality. So in you, it's not completely determined from what you describe, right? But what is a creative element like? In other words, what do they try to create? I see.
And making a decision, and if it chooses, it can choose to make it something that's likely to happen or something that's not likely, because it chooses the likely things. And the likely things that I would regard as a creative act, because it is, in fact, there's no equation for this fluctuating field. It's just given the field gives the probability. It's not that the field has any dynamics associated with it.
It sounds good. I would like to read your paper. I simply haven't read your paper yet, so it sounds good.
I'll talk about it.
Yeah, okay, good. Great. So I suppose we can finish, right? All right? Yes. But the moment you measure, you're in trouble, you know, because then you will break the identity of that actual entity. Okay. Well, once you measure it, then the connection across whatever distance it is broken, and you have separate entities. Okay. Now, as far as Aristotle is concerned, we are quoting him directly. He is the one who said that matter is pure potentiality. Sure, Aristotle connection is right on the mark. But is there anything beyond that? Yes. Yeah, right. Yes. Yes.
So, does this imply some sort of holistic version of the property?
It could lead that, yeah, it could lead that way. It could lead that way, yes. I mean, I don't know, it all depends what you do with it, but it could be developed in that direction. But that doesn't seem to completely answer your question. All right, well, we can talk about it tomorrow, if you wish. Okay, coffee time, huh?